You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hi, Cardinal fans. I'm Ozzie Smith.
Corks one into right down the line. It may go.
And you're listening to the Cardinals Insider Podcast.
Go crazy, folks. Go crazy.
Here's your host, Brent McMillan.
Welcome into the Cardinals Insider Podcast. I'm Brett McMillan. Glad that you could be with us today, and you're going to be rewarded for joining the conversation. Because when you get two people who are known by just a single name, Ozzie and Gibby, you know that you've got some star power working. This episode featuring a conversation between Ozzie Smith and Bob Gibson. They were kind enough to sit down and talk for us on opening day, and they got into a lot of really interesting topics, including Bob Gibson's pitching philosophy, that famous 1968 season that he put together, and how he dealt with racism as an African-American player in the 1960s. Some amazing Cardinal history and some amazing baseball history here as part of this talk, and we're really glad that you could join us for it today. So here it is, Ozzie and Gibby on the Cardinals Insider Podcast.
You know, Bob, we touched on it a little bit here, but you came up in a time where it couldn't have been easy as an African American player. Talk to us a little bit about how and what times were like in the 50s when you broke into the big leagues.
Yeah, I signed with the Cardinals in July, probably 31st of July, and. What year? 1957. And
see, I was a little boy. I was only 3 years old, so I watched you when I was a little boy.
I was expecting you to say I wasn't even born yet. Nobody else was. And the times back in 57 was different. It was different. The living conditions, you know, if you happen to be an African American player, you weren't allowed to stay with the rest of your teammates unless they were African American, and you weren't.
So let me ask you. So when you went into a town, the team stays in a hotel. You guys were not allowed to stay in the hotel.
What? Not in the same hotel? And you know, if you go to the ghetto and there was a hotel there, which most of the time there wasn't, you had to stay in that hotel or. They made provisions for you to stay in somebody's house. Some family, which kind of put a little damper on the situation, but you weren't allowed to stay with the team. But that wasn't just in professional sports either. That happened to me when I was at Creighton. We went from Omaha to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and about halfway to Tulsa, the basketball coach came
over. Now, this is when you were playing basketball.
This is when I was playing basketball with Creighton. And our coach came over about halfway to Tulsa, and he says, Bob, I got to sit and talk with you here for a second. I said, yeah, what's up? He says, when we get to Tulsa, you won't be able to stay with the rest of the team. What you talking about?
You know, sound like Willis.
Yeah.
What you talking about, Willis?
I says, well, why not? Well, explain it to me. And we have a place for you to stay. We have a house for you to stay in. And there was a guy that I grew up with. His name was Glenn Sullivan. And he was on Creighton's basketball team. And he grew up in the housing projects with me. Believe it or not, the housing projects were segregated also. The African Americans stayed on one side. And on the other three sides were white families. But Glenn Sullivan was always over with us. And we went to high school together. We went to college together. He was a little older.
No, he was white? Was Glenn Sullivan white?
Yes,
oh,
yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And he just said, hey, don't worry about it. I'll go stay with you. And so he went and stayed with me in this house in Tulsa, Oklahoma, while the other guys stayed in the hotel. And that's the first time I'd ever experienced that. So when I got to the Cardinals, and not necessarily the Major League team, AAA, Omaha was AAA. When we went to anywhere in the South, would not stay with the rest of the players. And Sullivan
was right there with
me. Yeah, and that was difficult. And the tough part about it, all of these things that are going through your head, the way you're being treated. I remember going down, and we stopped in Oklahoma City. This is going back to the college. Mm-hmm. We stopped in Oklahoma City. The players got off, the rest of the white players, I was the only black player, got off and went into the train station to eat. They brought dinner back to me on the bus. And or the train. So, I say I lost a point.
No. It's as far as the what effect that had on you.
Yes, that's what I was. You know, these days I got to tie a string around my finger so I can remember. Then I forget where I put the string. You had to do that and then perform on the field just like everybody else.
Yeah.
And it was very difficult.
Well, let me ask you, did that have anything to do with your competitiveness and how you were driven?
I really don't think so.
Okay.
I think my upbringing in the housing project in itself, I mean, we had to fight almost every day. You know, and if you thought that you couldn't win the fight, you had to hide and try to keep out of the guy's ways. And there was all kind of bullies and what have you. And I think I learned that there more so than in school. My oldest brother, he had basketball teams and baseball teams and football teams. He would take us to all these small towns. And then whenever he thought we were not being treated fairly, being cheated or what have you, he'd go out in the middle of the field and just challenge people. And we always thought somebody was going to kill him, you know, because we were going to a city, a little town. There were 200-300 people there watching us play.
Was he a big guy?
He was heavy. He was 5'10", and he weighed about 240. Okay. So he wasn't small.
Right.
But he wasn't big enough to beat up 10 people, right. You know, which he'd stand out there and just challenge them. You're going to cheat my kids out here. We're going to get in a truck, and we're going to go home. And I think I learned that competitiveness from him more than anything else.
Yeah. Skill-wise, from a pitching standpoint, where did all that come from?
He taught me.
He taught you.
He taught me.
When you say he taught you, what did he? What are the particular things that he talked about?
Well, what he did, he was a coach to begin with, but he would buy books, how-to. And he'd buy these books and make me sit down with him. And we'd go over, and they'd had pictures of how to hold a ball and what to do. And the 90-degree arm and don't down and up. And just all of this stuff. And he just watched me like a hawk. And I used to think he was unfair because he always wanted me to be better than everybody else. And he would hold me to a little higher standards than he would the rest of the guys. And it would be because he spent so much time with me. He would take me out on a field and he would catch and have me throw to him, and he would correct whatever I was doing wrong, you know? And then I told you before, he was like a father, and he was old enough, you know, where he did a pretty good job not only teaching me how to play sports, but teaching me a little bit about life and do's and don'ts and what have you.
You know, I think all of us that have been fortunate enough to make it to the Hall of Fame had people in our lives that were, they all taught us the same, or they gave us the same message about competing. You know, talking about having a person. I had a coach by the name of Glenn Ezell, who I felt rode me more than he rode everybody else. And he did that because he saw that something special in me, and he never wanted me to walk away from it not having given my all. And I felt, and when I went to Instructional League, and this is where I met Glenn, I went to Instructional League, And I can remember him, come give me more, Hoss. Come on, Hoss. Stay on it. And I'm running my tongue out because I'm trying to make it to the big leagues. You know, I'm working hard every day. I'm running it out. I'm diving. I'm all of this stuff. Until one day, after instructional, he came to me and he said, Hoss, I know you think I've been riding you and been on you a lot. He said, but I've always felt that you had something special. And I'm here to tell you today that you got an invite to big league camp. And that day was probably one of the greatest days of my life because it's what you fight for, you know, and to get that chance and to have somebody like that to believe in you. And I think that all of us at some point in time have had that person in our life that believed in us.
Yeah, I was lucky because I had two. After my brother Josh, who brought me all the way up, I got into high school. And then after you get into high school, you've got to pretty much pay attention to your coaches and what have you there.
Yeah.
I had a coach, a white coach, his name was Neil Mosser. And in fact, in my first year on the varsity, I was a sophomore. We went to a state tournament, it was the first time in the state of Nebraska where five black guys started on the floor. You could hear a pin drop. Could hear a pin drop. There's no clapping, no anything. And within the first half, we had 1 minute left in the first half, every one of the guys except me had fouled out of the ball game. And I never foul out of the ball game. And within the first minute of the second half, I fouled out.
Wow.
So they got rid of us, and we got beat 39-40.
Wow.
But Neil Mosser also got kicked out of the game.
Yeah.
You know,
for good reason.
But this guy... he was the same type of personality as Josh. He wasn't Josh's size, but he knew what was going on in the world, and I thought the world of him.
Yeah. So, in moving on, you know, when you came to the Cardinals, you were here in what year did you come up?
1959.
What was it that that brought you to coming to St. Louis? And I guess being in the Midwest, it probably wasn't that much different from Omaha, the experience as far as people are concerned.
Well, yeah, the experience was a little different, I believe. When I came to St. Louis, racism was out there in your face. In Omaha, even though it's only like 450 miles from here, it was a little different, but did it exist? Absolutely. But it wasn't in your face. And they didn't come up to you and tell you couldn't do this, you know, and they didn't have signs telling you couldn't go here and you couldn't go there. It was a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And here you knew where your place was, mm-hmm. so-called.
Yeah.
And
when did that change?
It changed in 1962. It changed in Florida for me and for us, for the Cardinal ball players, and Bill White had a lot to do with that. They had all these signs about don't drink out of this fountain. Always had two fountains, had two bathrooms, had all of that, and I always went into the wrong one. I just don't know why.
There's only Bob Wood.
I would drink out of that other faucet to see if it was going to kill anybody. Didn't kill anybody.
Yeah.
But 62 is about when it changed, 61, 62. And it started being a little bit more subdued. You know, people didn't really get in your face. That's not to say that it didn't happen. It
didn't exist.
It existed. But people started to get a little better. And I thought that, and I still think it, that sports has a lot to do with that. It has a lot to do with teaching people how to live together, how to respect each other, how to respect ability, you know. Somebody couldn't play, I don't like them either. You know, get them out of here.
Didn't matter whether black or white.
You can't play, get him out of here.
Yeah.
But I think it did. Sports does an awful lot to change people's minds about who this person is. And if you don't get to be around a person, you're not going to ever find out what they're all about. But sports puts you around these people, uh-huh. day in and day out. you're not really so bad. So, you haven't pissed me off yet.
You know, you had this reputation of being this guy that didn't, you didn't deal with the opposition. You didn't talk to the opposition. Now, let me ask you, if Bill White was on the other team, would you not talk to him?
No, I would talk to him.
Okay.
Because we were on the team together.
But I'm saying that...
If we had never been on the same team?
Right, when did you get traded? You got traded. Oh, he got traded.
He got traded.
And
to
so...
the Cardinals.
From where?
From the Cardinals. Bill White came from San Francisco to the Cardinals for Sad Sam Jones, pitcher.
Okay.
And that was in 1958 or 9. And if Bill had still been on San Francisco's team, I probably wouldn't talk to him.
Even with the relationship?
Well, no, not after relationship. That changed everything. There's one guy I never played with that I used to joke around with all the time, and I don't know why. It was Willie Stargell. I just liked him.
Yeah.
And I would kind of kid him. I wouldn't spend time doing it, but I'd walk by him and say something to him, maybe nudge him. We're going to get you today or something like that. But I did like him, and he was the one person that was on the team that wasn't mine that I kind of talked to and what have you.
Did he ever take you deep?
Yeah.
And that's a simple question. Did he ever take you deep?
Well, now, what difference does that make?
Okay, all right. Well, forget the question. Scratch that.
A couple of times.
Yeah.
He hit a ball off of me one time. He hit a ball off of me. It went over my shoulder, my left shoulder. I tried to catch it, and I couldn't catch it. It was hit so hard, and I turned around and looked, and it was going up into the stand in center field. I go, ooh, good thing I didn't. That would have turned me right over.
Yeah, I've heard a couple stories about him hitting balls
that got
out in a hurry.
Left-hander, you know, I had more trouble with left-handers than I did right-handers, which was normal. And this is really funny though. It's how hard this game is, because as a pitcher, they teach you to keep the ball down. Keep the ball down. Well, if you keep the ball down, the left-handers, they'll kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Most
mm-hmm.
left-handers. So now you got to learn to pitch. You got to keep the ball up, or you got to keep it in, or you keep it away. You don't keep it away too often.
Yeah.
Most of them, those guys that hit the ball a long way are big guys.
Yeah.
And get that arm out there.
Mm-hmm. And drop it. Now, you talk about pitching. When did it come to you that you realized that you were in the upper echelon as far as pitching was concerned?
I was pitching 59, 60, 61. 61, Johnny King took over as the manager of the ball club. And he called me in his office. He says, Bob, you're going to start every 5 days. Regardless. So don't worry about getting a start. You're going to start. I want you to learn how to pitch. And up until that point,
this
I was
62.
61, I'm sorry, 61. 61. And up until that point, I was kind of a mop-up pitcher here. I would go down to the minor leagues for 2 weeks and win two ball games or three ball games and come back up and still be in the bullpen. And when he took over, he made me a starter. And that was in 61, and I won 13 games that year. And then it went up every year after that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Who was the toughest hitter you ever faced?
Well, that's tough.
Mm-hmm.
The toughest hitter, not the best hitter.
The toughest.
The toughest. There were two guys that hit me pretty well. One was Billy Williams. And the other one was Ron Fairley.
Dodgers.
Ron Fairley would never hit a home run off you. But he just kept hitting singles over the shortstop's head and the second baseman's head, no matter what. I got to tell you a story about Ron Fairley. He got a hit, as he always does, or two. And I got a base hit, and I was on first base, and he's playing first base for the Dodgers. So he kind of... snuggles up to me and says, hey, Bob, he says, man, you really have good stuff. I don't know how anybody ever hits you. And I didn't say anything to him. I just took my lead, what have you. Joe Torre was catching. And the next time he came up, he looked at Joe and he says, "Hey, Joe, I'm not going to like this at bat, am I?" And Joe just started laughing. But hit him right in the middle of the back.
Back, right in the back.
That was the last time he said anything. get your hits and leave me alone.
Yeah, don't talk to me. 67, 68, let's talk about the those 2 years. What do you remember about 67 and 68?
Well, 67 was a tough year for me. I was going really well, and I ended up getting a brick in the ankle. Roberto Clemente hit a line drive down, and I couldn't get down fast enough to catch it. Hit me in the ankle and broke it. I had won 12 games. I had won 12 games before the All-Star break, and this was right before the All-Star break. And, of course, I rehabbed and the whole thing, and we came back at the end of the season in September, and I pitched and won that game, made me win 13. And that was a tough year for me, but I did a really good job of rehabbing, and while I was in the cast, I threw every day in the cast. We had Johnny Lewis, who was one of the
Cardinal hitting instructors.
Yeah, well, he was in the front office at the time, and he used to come out every day and catch me. Mm-hmm. I'd throw off the mound. I just wanted to keep my arm in shape, and I knew I wouldn't be able to really do everything the way I did on the mound when I was healthy, but I just wanted to keep my arm in shape. And so that year, we were against the Red Sox, and I won 3 games in the series. We won this World Series. Now, 68 was entirely different. 68, from the beginning to the end, I don't think I ever pitched any better. I mean, everything was just right on. I had a zone that I really believe, and I never tried it, but I believe that I could have closed my eyes and thrown the ball where I wanted to, or get within a distance of it. And I just didn't make a lot of bad pitches that year. And it was a tough year, though, as far as the Cardinals were concerned, because we didn't score a lot of runs. But we won the championship again, and we didn't win the World Series. Right. We probably should have, but we didn't win it. Mm. And, Detroit won it. I don't think the best team won.
Okay. Now, that team, the Detroit team at that time had Denny McClain.
McClain.
Mickey Lolich. Who were the other pitchers on that staff?
I can't remember day before yesterday. Yeah. I can't remember who they
Those were the two standouts.
Yeah.
Was that the year that Denny McClain won 30?
He won 30 games. Yeah, and he wasn't, as far as we're concerned, he wasn't their best pitcher. Lolich was.
Lolich. Uh-huh.
Yeah. But sometimes the best pitcher didn't win, and I'll tell you why. Because they would always match the best pitcher against the other team's best pitcher. Mm-hmm. And it was just a flip of the coin who was going to win that ball game. And in 68, I must have pitched against Koufax 5 times. You know, mm-hmm. It seems like I did. It seems like I pitched against him every other week. And we couldn't hit him. They weren't going to get but one run off of me. He beat me twice in 1 week, 1-0. And
wow.
It was just tough. So your best pitcher doesn't necessarily win all the games.
Yeah.
Because he's got a tough road to handle.
But he wins the ones that you need.
Yeah. He's the guy when you've lost 4 games in a row and you need somebody to stop that skid. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's why I've always felt that if you have 2 guys on your team that can give you a better than 50% chance of winning, 2 guys, you can always stop a bad streak.
Yes. Yeah, and you're going to have a good – if you got 2 guys that have outstanding years like that,
yeah,
you're going to be right in the hunt. Mm-hmm. If not winning it,
and then the other
going to be right there.
And then the other thing is being able to play defense, catch and throw.
Yeah.
You know, when I look back at my my career and everything, one of the things that, and we're going to close with this, is that I wish I would have had the opportunity to play with some body that had your dominance. I wonder what it would have been like to have been able to play, and I played with some guys that were good pitchers. But I mean a dominating pitcher who every day that he went out there, you know, he had a better than 50% chance of winning. And then you incorporate that with a guy who had some of my skills, and how that would have played off of each other, how good that would have been. And I wish I would have had the opportunity to play with somebody like you.
Well, I feel the same way about you. Of course, I've told you that. We had a good shortstop in Maxville. Maxie could catch the ball. His range wasn't really as good as yours, but he could catch the ball if you hit to him. But the added attraction, as far as I'm concerned with you, is that you could hit. Maxie couldn't hit too much at all, and then, of course, he didn't care about it. He said, I got to the big leagues by catching the ball, and that's the way I'm going to stay here, and which he was right.
Yeah.
But you could every once in a while, you make a mistake and hit a home run and stuff like that. So.
Well, you know what? It was all about, you know, I never came to this, or never played, wanting to be a one-dimensional player.
Yeah.
My idea was that if I was going to play, I was going to be as well-rounded a player as I could be. That if I was a good defensive player, I wanted to try and match that on the other side. And, you know, I came to the game notably as a defensive player, but I worked extremely hard at being a better offensive player because, you know, you can help your team both defensively and offensively. And that was always my goal. I didn't want to leave this game with people just saying that I was a one-dimensional player. All he could do was catch the ball and stuff. So I put forth the effort, the work, the blood, the sweat, and the tears. And I tell young kids today that you're only going to get out of something what you put in it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't put anything in it, you shouldn't expect anything in return. And that's really life. And so, you know, as I sit here today, I look back and I say that, you know, I didn't leave anything to chance. And if that meant that, you know, it put me in the place that I am, then that's just the way the chips, that's the way the cards fell. And I know that sitting here, every day that I went out there, I did the very best that I could. I didn't win every day. Our team didn't win every day. But I know that I gave everything I had that particular day.
See, we were a lot in that respect. I didn't want to be just a good pitcher. I wanted to be a good ball player.
Yes.
I used to go out, take extra batting practice. I used to steal bases.
And somebody hit your bat a couple times, accidentally.
Yeah. Well, it hanging.
Yeah.
And I would take infield. Sometimes I would play third base during batting practice, and I'd get in on the grass, and guys would hit balls by me, and I used to snag them. You know, unless it was hit too hard, then I'd jump out of the way. but I did all of those things, too, because I wanted to be a good ball player. I didn't just want to be a good pitcher.
Right.
And that's the way I felt about the game.
Well, good. I think you know how I feel about you. And I thank you so much for doing this.
Anytime.
My friend.
You know that.
Bob Gibson.
Ozzie also went one-on-one with Willie McGee for us. That and other past episodes are available at cardinals.com/podcast, or you can check them out on iTunes as well. If you've enjoyed this episode, be sure to check out the Cardinals Insider TV show, too. We profile current and former Cardinals, plus we just give you a behind-the-scenes look at day-to-day life here at Busch Stadium. Find local listings at cardinals.com/insider, or if you'd rather watch on demand, and hey, why not, you can head on over to cardinals.com/video or the MLB At Bat app as well. If you go to the app, simply just search Cardinals Insider in the video section. That's it for this episode of the podcast. For Ozzie Smith and Bob Gibson, I'm Brett McMillan. We'll talk to you next week on the Cardinals Insider Podcast.